Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. Online, we're at kpcg.fm and a live link at thetrumpet.com. A lot coming up on this Monday edition. The flu outbreak grips much of the United States. Maybe you're dealing with that, or you know someone who is. We'll have some details about that and how you can avoid it. President Trump's travel ban highlights even more division in the U.S., turning kind of ugly. And a study finds many college students, in fact, aren't ready for college. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online, kpcg.fm. We have a live link, too, at the trumpet.com. Thanks for joining us in those locations, or also the TuneIn app if you can't catch the programming live. This show or any of the shows here on KPCG, you can find the archives online, kpcg.fm, SoundCloud, thetrumpet.com. Plenty of places to go. And check those out in case you can't catch it live. I'm Dwight Falk. Grant Turgeon normally here today, but he's out with the flu. The flu outbreak has hit a lot of places here in the U.S. ABC says that the seasonal flu reaches epidemic levels in the U.S. Seems like it comes around every year. The CDC has reported that 8 pediatric deaths have been reported due to seasonal influenza, and that 10 states have experienced high amounts of people with flu-like symptoms. Widespread influenza activity was reported in 37 states. So many of you listeners, you may know somebody that has it, or you might be battling with it yourself, unfortunately, but it is hitting up to 37 states, including our very own Oklahoma, where we are broadcasting from. And, of course, it always hits the youngest and the oldest the hardest. So, sadly, 8 pediatric deaths have been reported due to that seasonal illness of the flu. Currently, there are 15.4 flu-related hospitalizations per 100,000 people in the U.S. According to the CDC, most people can just rest for a few days and are typically better, but in some cases, it is more serious. The flu usually reaches epidemic levels, they say, in the U.S. at some point every year, and we're getting to that point. Of course, you know the symptoms if you've had it: headache, fever, joint pain, and cough. That's pretty standard. They say the seasonal flu generally spreads across the U.S. from November until March, the peak number usually occurring in February. So we're a couple days away from that, and it is, I guess, affecting more people. The number of people affected every year, of course, it varies widely depending on where you are and what's going on. But generally, the CDC reports that millions of people are sickened, hundreds of thousands are hospitalized, and thousands or tens of thousands of people do die from the flu every year. So a lot of times, I guess, I don't think of the flu as being deadly, but it is. It can be, especially for the young and the old. Here are some of the best ways to prevent the flu. These are sort of common sense, but it's good to review it from time to time. 6 ways that they say you can avoid the flu. Number 1, avoid close contact with people that are sick. Stay away from them. Ban them from your presence, and you won't spread it, hopefully. And, of course, if you're sick, it's good to stay home and rest as well. Also, they say, of course, that tying into that, just stay home when you're sick. If you have to cough or sneeze, cover your mouth and nose, which is always a good etiquette. Wash your hands, which is always good to do as well. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, or mouth. And number 6, sort of a general catch-all, practice other good health habits. Yeah, so there'd be a lot to think about there. Good eating and also good sleep. There's a lot of studies that show if you lack in sleep, your immune system weakens pretty quickly. So if you take caution and try to do those things, hopefully you won't get the flu and will be able to avoid that. Or if you get it, maybe you'll recover quicker. So that's going on around the U.S. This time of the year. Some of the headlines that have happened today and over the weekend that we'll talk about. This is one of the big ones that happened overnight. This terrorist attack in Canada, 6 dead, 8 injured in terrorist attack, they say, on Muslims, that's what they were calling it, at Quebec City Mosque. But it's kind of interesting, the story, you know, more details come out on it. We find out more about who is involved. Two suspects are in custody after a shooting at a mosque in Quebec City left six people dead and eight injured, officials said early Monday. And latest reports show that the suspect in the Quebec mosque terror attack was of Moroccan origin. So they said it was an attack against Muslims, which I guess it would be, but the attackers appear to be potentially Muslim as well. I don't know all the details there, but apparently they were shouting, or at least one of them was shouting Allah Akbar as they fired, and they were of Moroccan descent. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the shooting a terrorist attack on Muslims, offered his condolences. But again, as mentioned, one of the two gunmen was shouting Allah Akbar as he opened they opened fire, the two of them, at a mosque in Quebec City, and he was of Moroccan origin. A witness and local media reported Monday, revealing the first details about the attackers and the massacre that killed six men. So the first thing that they said was this is an attack against Muslims, and then later the details come out about who committed the attack. So not all the details are known yet, but it does appear that it is the attackers were Muslim too, I guess, or at least it appears that way. The terrorist suspects were identified as Mohammed Kadar and Alexander Bissonnette. The CBC reported the two men were arrested soon after the shooting at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center Sunday night and were expected to appear in court later Monday. So there'll be more details about that. You might be wondering how many terror attacks have been in Canada recently. Well, the statistics that they have, the latest ones, I guess, are 2015 that I could find. There were five official terror attacks in Canada in 2015. And if you look back over the last 20 years, some years are lower, of course, some years are higher. Five has been the most. Every year that's had five, that has been the highest level. And so here's another one in 2017. So it's getting to be quite interesting with a lot of the threat of terror. That's always something people think about, and it pops up just about anywhere. And that's, I guess, the nature of terrorism. And so in light of terrorism and the threats of terrorism, the Trump administration has taken aim at people coming into this country and has put in place some immigration restrictions, at least for a time, and that has caused quite a bit of a stir. Here's some sound from some of the protesters over the weekend and some of what they had to say about the travel ban here in the United States.
Protest the proposed ban on immigration and refugees from Muslim countries, because it's anti-American and unconstitutional to discriminate against people of a certain religion.
We want to reach people to tell them that this is the American way, that we are an inclusive society created by immigrants, and that what Trump is doing is un-American.
I think there's a lot of reasons. One is the so-called Muslim ban, his view on women, his view on immigrants, the things he's said about Mexican, his cabinet, a lot of things.
I just really stand for a united people and not for dividing people that have made up this country for so long.
So that's some of the sound from over the weekend, some of the protesters protesting this travel ban. And it's interesting, if you listen to their comments, they're pretty general. Not a lot of fact, really. It's some of what they're saying, I don't even know that the Trump administration has ever said, but they are saying what they've heard in the media, at least. So it's good. It's interesting as we go through this, because there's a question of law and legality, and the answer might be surprising to you as to whether President Trump can do this. In fact, the law says that he can't. So we'll take a look at that here in a moment. But there are a few nations here that they're not wanting people to come in from, at least for a while: Libya, Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. So if you think about that list, seems like a pretty good list. I know people are going to have different opinions about it, obviously. But as far as nations that have bred terrorism, those nations certainly have. Libya, Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran. If nothing else, you think you'd want to take a very close look at people coming in from those nations, because those nations are very radical, aren't they? You know, I would think so. So it's interesting. There's a lot of division here over this travel ban. This headline says from Fox News, Trump takes aim at Senator Schumer's quote-unquote tears in new defense of immigration restrictions. President Trump launched into a fiery Twitter defense of his controversial refugee and immigration restrictions Monday, blaming protesters and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer's quote-unquote tears for difficulties at U.S. airports and urging his opponents to, quote, study the world. So President Trump, of course, takes to Twitter very often. That's sort of his way of bypassing the media. And people have different opinions on that, but I can understand why he would want to bypass the media. They are pretty, they certainly want to paint the picture one way a lot of times, and they don't give the full picture, especially when it comes to some of the policies. A little background here. Trump signed an executive order on Friday that imposed a 120-day suspension. So it's a 120-day suspension at this point of the refugee program and a 90-day ban on travel to the U.S. from citizens of the seven terror hotspots. We just mentioned those, including Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and Sudan. The order sparked chaos, the article says, at the nation's airports as customs agents struggled to interpret the order and outraged civil rights groups and Democratic lawmakers, some of whom attended protests at the nation's airports where some travelers had been detained. So they're making it out like it was a massive deal, and I guess there were some protests, but from what I understand, the numbers, there weren't that many that were actually detained. Some were detained for a little bit while they checked some paperwork, and then I think there was just a handful that were actually maybe detained longer than that. I'm not sure, but those are the numbers I heard. But they're saying that it sparked chaos. Schumer, who is from New York, pledged to fight the order with every fiber of my being, he tweeted on Saturday. And he also tweeted that there are tears running down the cheeks of the Statue of Liberty tonight. A little bit of poetic license there, of course, but I think we all get what he was going for there. So there were some protests, and there was some an outbreak of some violence at airports. The Gateway Pundit has a video up of some fights between Donald Trump supporters, President Trump supporters, and those on the left, I guess. And it says the leftist mob in the video starts screaming at the man. They punched him, and he knocked him unconscious. And he was unconscious on the ground, and the crowd, and this is a leftist mob, I guess, they were screaming at him, quote, "That's right, Nazi boy," as the man lay on the ground. So if nothing else, there's a lot of division being caused by some of these policies that are being put into place. And I think the media has been surprised. I think a lot of people have been surprised that President Trump is actually doing what he said he was going to do. That's a rarity. Usually when people are running for office, they make promises and they usually don't fulfill them, or it takes a while, or it doesn't quite work out the way they thought or they said it would. And in this case, kind of everything he has said to this point he's been doing, and it's really surprised some people. And it has caused a lot of division. There's a really good article at thetrumpet.com today that you need to read, because if you watch the media reports about this, you're going to get, you know, some ideas and some opinions and some thoughts about it. But thetrumpet.com is a great write-up on it. I think it'll give you a lot of perspective, gave me a lot of perspective. The title is Hysterical Reaction to Immigration Order Further Divides Two Americas. So we have this division happening. There's these two Americas now. And, you know, the last time we had a really divided America would have been the Civil War, right? So obviously a horrible, horrible time period. And there is a real division that's happening there. And so check out that article at thetrumpet.com, Hysterical Reaction to Immigration Order. And it is hysterical. Even today I was watching the morning news on, I think it was CBS, and they interviewed somebody from President Trump's staff about the travel ban. And, of course, they were really peppering him with questions. And one of the points that they really jumped on, the media jumped on, was that President Trump had tweeted out that things were actually going pretty smoothly. And so I think it was Charlie Rose, he asked the gentleman from President Trump's cabinet or representative, I'm not sure exactly what position he fills, but he asked him, you know, well, how can he say it's going smoothly when all these headlines say this? And then he read the headlines where it said chaos and all these things. The thing I thought was so funny about that was that Charlie Rose is part of the media. I mean, they write those headlines. They're the ones that write the headlines in the first place. So to use what they wrote or what their media peers wrote as some sort of evidence, That's not evidence. That's just what they wrote. And it's part of that hysterical reaction, as the Trumpet talks about here. Here's a little bit from that Trumpet.com article. Just give you a touch of it, but go back and check that out if you have time today. It says, there is not one mention, quote, of Muslim ban in President Trump's executive order. But you would never know it judging by the media coverage. And then based, you know, even those clips that we played just of some of the people speaking about the protests, you know, they have all these ideas that they're throwing out there, but it's things that the media have said. It's not exactly the facts on the ground, but it influences people, of course. It says, where this Trumpet article continues, and where was this hysterical reaction when President Obama used a pen and a phone to restrict refugee admissions during his presidency? See, that's what's lost on this, is a lot was done in the past administration, too, and the media gave him a pass on it, where they don't give the Trump administration certainly that type of leeway today, whether they should or shouldn't, but they certainly aren't being fair in the way they're handling this administration in relation to the past one. The article continues, Obama banned Iraqi refugees in 2011. Where was the outrage about that? We're going to talk here in a minute about one of these award shows last night and all the outrage from the Hollywood actors. Where was the outrage in 2011? I don't remember that happening at all. It says it wasn't until his last year in office that he lifted the ban on Syrian refugees coming to America. And one of his final acts as president was to abolish the, quote, wet foot, dry foot policy that ensured a safe haven for Cuban refugees fleeing Castro's prison. Where's the outrage about that? There was really nothing said about that when it occurred. Not from the media anyway, not from the celebrities that are out there that like to talk about these things. And that's a really, you know, they're sending people back, Cubans back, that are going to be probably in a lot of difficulty because of leaving the country. And yet there's no talk about that. So the hypocrisy here is pretty evident. This article from the Trumpet continues, President Obama could do no wrong. And that's the way it was and is, I guess. They say President Trump, on the other hand, is Adolf Hitler and temporarily restricting immigration flow. It's just temporary at this time. Temporarily restricting immigration flow until the screening process can be improved is worse than Nazism. I think somebody even said that last night at one of those award shows. They said something about Nazism. And so you can see how people get divided quickly, right? I mean, if the media is making it out like one side, the left, is never wrong, and the other side, the Nazis, well, of course there's going to be division. And I think the media is accountable for that. But this article continues, and it says, by making President Donald Trump out to be like Hitler, the media is stirring up a lot of strong emotion. This emotion and this division will cause very real damage to America. And that's the bigger issue, is the division. But then it says, but there is hope. God does have a solution to the division. It is a solution that will in time make America great again, which is what a lot of people hope for, of course. It says, for this solution, watch the rest of Mr. Fleury's Key of David program, A House Divided Against Itself Cannot Stand. That program there is linked to this article on thetrumpet.com. Hysterical reaction to immigration order further divides two Americas. It's a top story today at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you check it out. Because if you just listen to the other media reports, it's very easy to get pretty sidetracked on the whole topic. But there's an interesting comment, too. Readers can write in comments, of course, to the different articles. And you can send us comments, too, by the way, to comments@kpcg.fm. We always appreciate those. But a comment was written into this article, which I thought was interesting. The writer gave a link to law.cornell.edu showing some of the laws of the land. People are talking about Nazism, and they're talking about President Trump doing all these things. Well, here's what the law says. 8 U.S. Code 1182. Inadmissible aliens, suspension of entry or imposition of restrictions by president. And this is a law, according to this this link. Whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation, and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate. So that's the law. But nobody at these protests is talking about what the law is. They're just having temper tantrums and fighting each other, or fighting, you know, the other side. And so, but that's what the law says, according to this, according to the law.cornell.edu. So it is interesting. Of course, I'm sure there's a lot of, there'd be a lot to get into there on that topic, but it's just interesting to see that that law is in place. And so it's going to be an interesting week. I think somebody was mentioning recently, might have been on the Trump Daily Radio Show, that Stephen Fleury mentioning that, you know, President Trump's only been in like a week and a half or something. And just look at all the things that have happened and all the controversy and all the division. So it is going to be very interesting weeks and months and maybe years ahead. So we'll see. We'll see how that continues to go. This is a really interesting write-up here. This is, we talked about this lady a while ago. Her name was, she just died, her name was Brynhilde Palmsell. And she died, I guess, in the last few days. She was 106 years old. You might remember her from being one of the last people that was sort of in Hitler's inner circle. She is a former secretary of Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. And so she died, 106 years old. And she really looked pretty good. I mean, about as good as you can look for being 106. But it's really interesting. She lived most of her life in relative obscurity until a German newspaper published an interview with her in 2011, prompting a flurry of interest in one of the last surviving members of the Nazi leadership's inner circle. So it's such a fascinating time period, a very dark time period, but people are always, I think, fascinated by that history. And so here is a living witness to it, and there's not too many that are still alive that witnessed it, let alone kind of being in the circle. I mean, she was just a secretary there. It wasn't like she was in on the, you know, all the meetings or anything. But at the same time, I mean, she was there and she got to see these people up close and personally just about every day. And so what she had to say was always pretty interesting. But she died. Her death was confirmed on Sunday to the Associated Press and by Christian Krohns. He's a director and producer of the film A German Life. That's the film that she was in. It's a documentary. They made it just about a year ago, I think. And she talks about what she saw, what she witnessed. And so it's pretty interesting. Her name, again, is Brynhilde Palmsell. And in the documentary, Palmsell talks about her three years working for the man responsible for spreading Adolf Hitler's ideology in newspapers and across the airwaves. So if you remember that history, Joseph Goebbels was the propaganda minister, I believe. He was in charge of the propaganda there in Nazi Germany, and of course he was effective in what he did for a time. Palmsell had been very lucid when she last spoke to Krohns on her birthday. That was January the 11th, so that was only a few weeks ago. She was very lucid, and you know, for being that age, still very clear in her her thinking, at least to some extent. And he said she died in her sleep at her Munich home on Friday. And so we had talked about her a little while ago because of this film, A German Life, that has come out, this documentary. And she says some interesting things. She gave an interview to the Guardian newspaper, and that was just last year, I believe. And they said that Palmsell is giving one of the first and last in-depth interviews of her life at the age of 105, so that was last year. And having lost her sight last year, they said, she says she is relieved that her days are numbered. So she got to that point where she was happy to, say goodbye to this life. She'd had had quite a few experiences, 105 years, 106 years at the end. She said, in the little time that's left to me, and again, this was a year ago, she said, in the little time that's left to me, and I hope it will be months rather than years, I just cling to the hope that the world doesn't turn upside down again as it did then. Though there have been some ghastly developments, haven't there? She asked. I'm relieved I never had any children that I have to worry about. And I think we talked about that quote a while ago when that film came out. But that was her hope, because she had seen the world turn upside down with the Nazis and everything that happened after that fact. Where she exactly stood on that issue is a little ambiguous. I don't know what she thought about the Nazis exactly, but she saw the world turn upside down, if nothing else. And she just hopes that didn't happen again. But she said, you know, it is sort of ghastly, isn't it, some of the developments. She didn't elaborate, but she thought there were some ghastly developments. And she was relieved she never had any children to worry about. And of course, she would have had grandchildren and great-grandchildren at that age. But that's it's an interesting perspective. She said a few other things of interest. She said, those people nowadays who say they would have stood up against the Nazis, I believe they are sincere in meaning that, but believe me, she said, most of them wouldn't have. So again, you know, she was right there. She experienced it all. She said, yeah, people say they would stand up against it, but she said they would not have. She said, the whole country, the country of Germany, the whole country was as if under a kind of a spell. She said, I could open myself up to the accusations that I wasn't interested in politics, but the truth is, the idealism of youth might easily have led to having your neck broken. And there were a few people that stood up, young people, I suppose, against the Nazi party. And like she said, though, you could get your neck broken for that. You know, people that stood up didn't last very long. And so some did. There were some movements that did try to stand up to it, but they obviously were not successful. But how interesting, right? I mean, she was right there. She experienced all of this. And she said the whole country was as if under a kind of a spell. You know, and she was there, and she observed that firsthand. And so really interesting history. She talks a little bit about Joseph Goebbels. He came into the office every day. And she got to know him a little bit. And this Guardian article says she recalls her boss as being short but well-kept. So he was a shorter fella. And of a gentlemanly countenance, who wore suits of the best cloth and always had a light tan. She said he had well-groomed hands. For some reason, she noticed that, that he probably had a manicure every day, she says. And she said she really had nothing to criticize about him, but he was kind of two different people. She says they said only occasionally did she get a glimpse of the man who turned lying into an art in pursuit of the Nazis' murderous goals. She was terrified to see him on stage at Berlin's Sportpalast, delivering his infamous Total War speech in February of 1943. She and another colleague had been given ringside seats just behind Magda Goebbels. It was shortly after the Battle of Stalingrad, and Goebbels hoped to get popular support to pull out all the stops to fight the threats facing Germany. And she said no actor could have been any better at the transformation from a civilized, serious person into a ranting, rowdy man. In the office, he had a kind of noble elegance, and then to see him there like a raging midget, because he was shorter, I guess, you just can't imagine a greater contrast. So pretty interesting that she notes the contrast there. But again, as the article points out, Goebbels was a master at lying. I mean, he was great at it. And so his life was a lie too, wasn't it? Where he would come into the office, he would appear one way, and then he would appear another way somewhere else. You know, you could say he sort of appeared like an angel of light. There's a lot about him that was looked good, but you look at what he did, and obviously it was terrible. So really interesting insight from this lady that got to see that up close. And she talks a little bit about the end of the Nazi regime, too. They say it was the day after Hitler's birthday in 1945 that her life, as she knew it, came to an abrupt halt. Goebbels and his entourage were ordered to join Hitler in his subterranean air raid shelter, the so-called Führer bunker. And there's a lot of good history books about that. It's kind of interesting to read those. During the last days of the war, she said, it felt as if something inside me had died. We tried to make sure we didn't run out of alcohol that was urgently needed in order to retain the numbness. She lifts an index finger as she takes pains to tell events in their right order, recalling how Goebbels' assistant came with the news on the 30th of April that Hitler had killed himself, followed a day later by Goebbels. She said, we asked him, and his wife as well? Yes. And the children? The children too. And at that point, she bows her head and shakes it as she adds, we were dumbstruck. So you can even go today, I mean, you can go right now on YouTube and look up Joseph Goebbels. And there's home videos of him and his wife and his children, you know, little kids playing, having fun, going down a slide. And you realize just a few years later, they were all dead. They killed themselves and they killed their kids too. So that certainly shows the spirit that was behind some of those events there. But really pretty eerie and really interesting history there in Germany. And so that lady that experienced a lot of that, she died here in the last few days, Brunhilde Pomsel, former secretary of Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. She was 106 years old. Pretty interesting. And if you ever get a chance to see the film, A German Life, it has some interesting insight in it as well. Well, everybody, I think, gets excited about buried treasure for the most part. Everyone's probably wanted to find some at some point. We have archaeology projects that the students here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, where we're broadcasting from, they work on from time to time. And so if you can find something that's significant, that's huge, and if you can find treasure, that's exciting too. Well, some treasure was found, not in that area of the world, but somewhere else. Buried treasure, it says, is from Fox News. Ancient grave found brimming with jewels. An Iron Age tomb brimming with treasures fashioned out of gold, bronze, and amber was recently uncovered after lying undisturbed by the Danube River for nearly 2,600 years, according to archaeologists. The glitzy hoard adorned the surrounded the skeleton of a woman who likely died between the age of 30 and 40, and it suggests that she was an elite member of the Celtic society, they think, that buried her in ancient southern Germany at a hill fort called Hunenberg in 583 BC, according to the research. So they feel like they can pin this down pretty closely. It says, moreover, the presence of a petrified sea urchin and arid ammonite, a type of extinct mollusk, in the grave are intriguing and suggest that the woman was kind of a priestess of some sort. And the study's lead researcher, Dirk Kraus, the archaeologist for the German state of Baden-Württemberg. That's what they think anyway. So there was this extinct animal in there. And I guess this other type of animal. A little bit strange, but I guess that was part of their custom. But the treasure was the thing that's probably more interesting. The large grave held myriad treasures, intricate jewelry made of amber, gold and bronze, piles of furs and textiles, an ornament made out of boar's horns and bronze jingle bells that would have adorned a horse's chest, carved boxwood objects, bracelets carved from black stone, and a belt made of bronze and leather. So I don't know how valuable that would be if it's, you know, I guess more of a historical value, but still very interesting. And they say the jewelry and belt covered the 5'3" tall skeleton of the elite woman. That's pretty average height, I guess. On the opposite side of the chamber, researchers found the skeleton of what was likely a woman measuring just 5'1" tall. The woman whose remains were buried with just a few pieces of bronze jewelry may have been a servant, they think. So even in death, they didn't get as much. They went to their grave with only a few pieces of jewelry, and the other lady got all the good stuff, I guess. So that's, I guess, the way they did it back then. So kind of interesting. It's always, I think, somewhat interesting when they find something, and especially when there's treasure involved. That's everybody's dream, I guess, when you're a kid especially and you think about that type of thing. So kind of interesting there, some archaeological finds over in Germany. Every once in a while you do see people, like just say even on the beach or something, with metal detectors or walking around different places at the parks. And I don't know, sometimes people find things. So the stuff is out there, buried beneath the surface. Kind of interesting to think about what might be down in some of those areas. So, of course, this one happened. This is a getting back to the situation with the travel ban, Donald Trump, President Trump's travel ban. Politically charged speeches at the SAG Awards take aim at Trump. That stands for the Screen Actors Guild Awards. It seems like they're having an award show every weekend for movies. I don't know. Maybe it's just this time of year. I don't pay a lot of attention to those necessarily, nor do I know what most of the movies are. But they have these award shows, and they've turned into, and maybe they've always been, but they've really turned into kind of political discourses, I guess, to where when they win an award, they get up and they just want to talk about politics. So it says politics took center stage at the Screen Actors Guild Awards on Sunday night as award winners used the spotlight to slam President Donald Trump's halting of immigrants from 7 predominantly Muslim nations. So not surprising. I don't think anybody would get up there and support him because they know, you know, you got to take the temperature of the room, as they say. And obviously that would be a room full of a lot of people that would be anti-President Trump for sure. They say the most blistering speech of the night came from David Harbour, one of the stars of the Netflix hit Stranger Things. He was on stage to accept Best Ensemble in a TV drama series. I'm not familiar with that show. I think I've seen a commercial for it. Some sort of sci-fi slash horror show. So that's what he's on, and he had some things to say, and this is what he said. He said, quote, "It's a call to arms from our fellow craftsmen and women to go deeper and through our art to battle against fear, self-centeredness, and exclusivity of our predominantly narcissistic culture, and through our craft to cultivate a more empathetic and understanding society by revealing intimate truths that serve as a forceful reminder to folks that when they feel broken and afraid and tired, they are not alone." So that was a run-on sentence. That was an entire paragraph, and no periods. So I don't know if that's the way he said it, but that's the way it was written. And, of course, people cheered, and they were excited about his comments. But I thought it was interesting that he was kind of taking a shot at self-centeredness, exclusivity, and predominantly narcissistic culture. I mean, if you could sum up Hollywood in a few words or phrases, wouldn't that be it? When you think of Hollywood and actors, self-centered, exclusive, predominantly narcissistic. You know, if I just read that and I had to pick any random group, who fits that bill? Well, it'd be Hollywood, wouldn't it? So he's taking a shot at that, and he thinks the culture is too much that way, and they need to battle against it. I think they're probably the biggest perpetrators of it in a lot of ways. And again, he's on a program that is a sci-fi horror show, so I'm not sure how he's doing that personally, but these award shows are taking aim at policies that they do not agree with. So anyway, take that for what it's worth, but just kind of interesting to take a shot at some things that I think really is the pot calling the kettle black, as they would say. In related note to that, Starbucks is pledged to hire 10,000 refugees. So if you're looking for a summer job, you may be in luck, you may not be, I don't know. Starbucks says it plans to hire 10,000 refugees over 5 years in the 75 countries where it does business. So they're going to try to, I guess, take their stand and help refugees out, which, again, I think is they're taking a shot against this travel ban, but sort of misplaced. I think if they hire those people and they need a job, that'd be great. But they're trying to take a stand, I guess. Chairman and CEO Howard Schultz outlined the company's plan in a memo sent to employees Sunday in response to President Trump's executive order banning travel from 7 Muslim-majority countries. He says, "We are living in an unprecedented time," he said in the memo, "and they're trying to reinforce the belief in our partners around the world." And so they're going to try to hire all of these different refugees into Starbucks, I guess. So take that for whatever it's worth. It'd be interesting to see, I guess, just some of these people have these comments that they're making about this travel ban. But again, it just highlights the division that's happening in the country. And you need to read the article from thetrumpet.com. Hysterical reaction to immigration order further divides two Americas. And just a really good write-up there. It'll give you some good balance and some perspective, I think, on the issue, because there's a lot being said about it, but it is hard to get proper balance and proper take the proper perspective on it without that balance. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com, too. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. And again, if you have any comments you'd like to send in, please do so. We'd like to read those comments at kpcg.fm. Key of David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG, as well as the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Also, Monday, Music for Life coming up this afternoon, and Just the Best Literature, too. So a lot of great programming here on KPCG. You're thinking to yourself, that's a lot. I don't know if I can listen to it all. Yes, you can. You just have to go to the archives. If you can't listen live because of your busy schedule, go to the archives, download the programming, listen to it at your leisure. Also, one other thing to mention to you, we've got an exciting concert coming up tonight and tomorrow night. Of course, if you're not in the listening area over the air, this may be a little tougher for you to get to, but we have a lot of listeners over the air at 101.3, and it'll be interesting to those online at kpcg.fm as well, and that is a concert. Ballet, armstrongauditorium.org has the details for you. It's Don Quixote, And the Russian National Ballet Theater, they always put on a tremendous show if you've seen those before. It's always amazing to see how the stage at the Armstrong Auditorium transforms. When they put the backdrop in, it looks like another place, another time. Really, really quite amazing. And, of course, they're just a fantastic ballet theater. The show is at 7:30 p.m. It is Monday and Tuesday evening. I think there might be a few tickets still available. You can check that online at armstrongauditorium.org. And the write-up says, the immense popularity of Leon Minkus' Don Quixote was thanks in large part to American Ballet Theater artistic director Mikhail Baryshnikov's 1983 production, broadcast nationwide on public television from the Metropolitan Opera House at Lincoln Center. Set in classical Spain, Don Quixote features some of the most captivating choreography, daring leaps, high extensions, etc. So if you know quite a bit about ballet, I think obviously you'd appreciate it even more than the commoner such as myself, but I can appreciate it as well. Very artistic, very athletic, and really amazing production that they put on. Don Quixote, that is tonight, Monday night and Tuesday night at Armstrong Auditorium, 7:30 p.m. Some tickets still available. You can check out armstrongauditorium.org for more information, and hope to see you out there. And if you've been to Armstrong Auditorium, you know there's, as they say, they always say there's not a bad seat in the house, but it is especially true. You're going to be close to the action no matter where you are in the theater. So that'll be exciting, and we look forward to seeing you out there. Here's a quick little story that should terrify all of us. I mean, this is like straight out of some movie you don't want to watch. But this is happening. This is a Science Today. First human pig embryos made, then destroyed. You heard that right. First human pig embryos made, then destroyed. But the scary thing is, eventually they probably won't be destroyed. A little bit from this write-up here. It says, using stem cell technologies, researchers generated human cells and human tissues in the embryos of pigs and cattle. The research appeared in the journal Cell. Why? You know, I know what they're trying to do is they want to grow human organs and other animals so that they can harvest them and use them for transplants. But I just don't think people know what they're getting into. It says, despite this milestone, integrating cells from human and animal species is proving difficult, as you'd expect, and developing human organs remains at a considerable distance, according to Dr. Yun Wu, a staff scientist in the Gene Expression Laboratory at the Salk Institute and first author of the research. In the current study, Wu and their colleagues used gene editing techniques known as CRISPR/CAS9. I don't know if that means anything to anybody. I guess it does to the gene scientists. They used that to generate mice embryos lacking a pancreas. Then they inserted rat stem cells that contained a gene for the pancreas into these mutant embryos. Once implanted, the stem cells developed into a rat pancreas within a mouse embryo that ultimately, and importantly, they say, grew into a healthy mouse with a normal lifespan. Of course, you can't really ask the mouse, he's probably terrified, but there's not much he could say about it. It says, taking their idea a few steps further, the researchers used the same method to develop rat eyes and rat hearts within mice embryos. And Wu said they demonstrated the robustness of the system by genetically disabling the mouse host. They proved it was possible to generate rat organs within a host species. So it's a pretty in-depth thing that they're doing there, but I think we can get the point. It's kind of messing with stuff that probably shouldn't be messed with. They say, unexpectedly to the researchers, the mice delivered bonus organs after the injection of rat stem cells. It also grew gallbladders, which are present in mice but not in rats. So they're trying to get involved in some of this and crossbreed animals. Not breed, but, you know, inject them with cells that transform them in some way. And again, they made a human pig embryo and then destroyed it. So just some strange stuff. They're of course, coming at it from the evolutionary theory that you can mess with it and it won't matter. And denying that there's a creator that made things a certain way for a certain reason. And, of course, there's a lot that they're messing with that they shouldn't be, and they don't understand there. The Incredible Human Potential is a really important book that gives insight into that if you haven't looked at that in a while. Here's an interesting story about colleges. This is from the Hechinger Report. Most colleges enroll students who aren't prepared for higher education. So this is disturbing for future employers. And also, it highlights an interesting trend that a lot of students are coming out of college with massive debt but with no degree. It says a vast majority of public 2- and 4-year colleges report enrolling students, more than 500,000 of them, who are not ready for college-level work. And that's an investigation that was done in 44 states. So they come into college, they're of age, obviously, they've graduated high school, but they didn't really do what was needed in high school to be ready for college. So you have to question even the value of the high school diploma, I guess, at that point. The numbers reveal a glaring gap in the nation's education system. A high school diploma, they say, no matter how recently earned, doesn't guarantee that students are prepared for college courses. Higher education institutions across the country are forced to spend time, money, and energy to solve this disconnect. They must determine who's not ready for college and attempt to get those students up to speed as quickly as possible, or risk losing them because they can't stay, obviously, enrolled in the institution if they're failing out of it. And so what they have to do is, as they say, most schools place students in what are called remedial courses in math and English before they can move on to a full load of college-level credit-bearing courses. So you have these students coming into college that need to take, as they call them, remedial courses in math and in English before they can even really get into college classes, because they didn't learn the foundational principles in high school, but somehow got into college. It's interesting, because when you get into college, you know, you are supposed to take an ACT or SAT, and also then, you know, you need a certain grade point average typically, or at least that's the way it used to be. And a lot of people that were serious about going to college had to take college preparatory classes in high school, at least back in anciently when I went to high school. But so something's changing there where they're able to get into college but really aren't prepared for it, and it's causing problems for the universities. And it's a financial drain, not only on the students but also on colleges and taxpayers. It costs up to $7 billion a year to cover the gap between students that come into college and then trying to get them prepared to actually take courses that will work towards their degree. At least 569,751 students were enrolled in remedial classes the year that this survey was taken, which was pretty recently. The true total is likely much higher because of inconsistencies in the way states track this data that may not capture adults returning to school or part-time students. So these numbers are probably low. It's probably higher than that 569,000 that aren't ready for college. Since the rates are so high, that there's no question students are getting out of high school without the skills they need to succeed in college, said Alex Mayer, a senior research associate at MRDC, an education and social policy research organization. He said the other side of it is these students are not getting out of college for the most part. So you have this whole group of students coming into college, not prepared for it. And but you know what? It doesn't mean that it's free. They're still paying. And in a lot of cases, they're taking out loans, but they can't do the work. They're not even ready to do the work. And so you have people coming out of college, just dropping out or flunking out or just leaving, you know, for one reason or another, and they don't have a degree. And the whole idea of, I guess, if people are trying to rationalize getting into debt in college, and some people do that, they'd say, well, if I go into so much debt, and I come out with a good degree, I can earn a decent amount of money, and I can pay it back. And, of course, there's levels of diminishing returns on some of that thinking. But some of these people are getting out of college with massive debts and really nothing else to show for it. They have a percent here of all first-time students placed in remedial courses. So this is just the, you know, like if you come in as a freshman. They don't talk about those that are in the, you know, maybe have made it through a grade or in their sophomore or junior or something, but still need to go to some of these courses. I suppose they couldn't be much beyond a sophomore because they would take those courses in those first 2 years. But these are the numbers for that. Percent of all first-time students placed in remedial courses. Maine, 49% of the students. New Jersey, 46%. Arkansas at 41%. Here in Oklahoma, 39%. Kansas, 39%. Kentucky, 36%. Massachusetts, 36%. Texas, 36%. Montana's at 32%. West Virginia, 29%. North Dakota, 28%. Utah, 28%. Michigan, 22%. Wyoming, 19%. Georgia, 16%. Kansas, 14%. And Oregon at 13%. Those are the numbers, the percentage of first-time students placed in remedial courses. So if you're looking to be a college professor and you want a lot of people coming to your course, you teach remedial math and English, you're going to have a full house, it seems like, because they have to take it. And but, you know, Maine and New Jersey, I mean, you got almost half the students coming into college that need to go back to remedial English and math, which is pretty amazing. And so, again, it is a huge cost. And you just, again, you have to wonder, well, what are they teaching them in high school? How did they get accepted to the college in the first place if they can't complete some of those basic courses? And again, this highlights another trend, which ABC points out. Their title is College Debt, No Degree Means World of Financial Hurt. They say about 45% of people who are no longer in college and have student loan debt said that college was not worth the cost, according to a survey from the Consumer Reports National Research Center. And about 1,500 Americans responded to the national survey that was in March. Consumer Reports partnered with the Center for Investigative Reporting to examine student loans in a social media campaign dubbed #MyDebtCouldBuy as part of the discussion. That's a bad feeling, right? You think about how much, say, debt you have, of student loan debt, and you think, wow, if I had that money, I could buy this, this, or this. And usually you'd buy quite a bit, I guess. They say what's interesting is that those with second thoughts likely didn't finish school. So there are those that went and did get some debt, but they got a good degree and they got a good job and they thought it was worth it to them. If you can go through without debt, always, always, always a better option, obviously. Probably not an option for everybody. And so, but some people felt like it was maybe worth it to them and others didn't. Those who didn't feel like it was worth it to them to go into all this debt to go to college are mostly ones that didn't graduate with a degree. They didn't graduate. And so they've got this debt and nothing really to show for it. On average, college grads in the class of 2016 have a record level of about $37,000 in student loan debt. Imagine that. You know, you come out of college with that. Amazing. For those with a bachelor's degree, and at least in those cases, they do have a bachelor's degree. That's up about 6% from last year, according to some of the calculations. About 71% of those graduating will do so with some student loans. So what's interesting, though, is that if people are coming out with a bachelor's degree have an average of about $37,000 in debt, and that is 6% higher than last year. Now, students coming out with a bachelor's degree are getting jobs that on average pay decently. And the raise in rates in terms of what they're being paid from the year before, I think, was about 3%. So they are getting paid more. So, but the numbers don't work out, do they? You get 3% more pay, 6% more debt. So you're going backwards in those numbers. So kind of interesting story to look at there. And I don't know, maybe it would be surprising to some. Maybe others wouldn't be surprised by that. But most colleges are enrolling students who aren't prepared for higher education. And I guess that would just push people to go and get more advanced degrees to separate themselves. Because if you can go in and kind of get a degree and not even really know, in some cases, some of the basics, or at least have to take classes in the basics again, I guess the value of those degrees would be questioned to some extent. One last story to talk about here briefly. It's a really interesting write-up. And again, it's one of those stories, I guess you just kind of have to take it for what it's worth, because it's hard to say if there's much to this, but you know, you probably have known somebody that's maybe you've heard a story about somebody dying at their last moments, or maybe you've witnessed it. Not something we like to talk about too much, but there's always this thought that people's lives flash before their eyes. Well, they did a study on that. The Telegraph, co.uk, they say your life really does flash before your eyes before you die, according to this study. They say research on those who have had, quote, near-death experiences suggest that the phenomenon rarely involves flashbacks in chronological order, as happens in Hollywood films. So in movies, you always see people's lives kind of go back in some sort of chronological order, but they say it probably doesn't happen that way. Participants that think they've had near-death experiences and talked about it, said that there was rarely any order to their life memories and that they seemed to come at random and sometimes simultaneously. Often the mind played tricks, they said, with people reliving their own experiences from the point of view of others who had been involved. I don't know if you've ever had that happen to you. I think I have, maybe in a dream or a memory or something. And they say the study found that many of the flashbacks involved intensely emotional moments, which you would expect, something that really impacted a person. And those things all kind of flood back, they say. So that's a sort of an interesting thought anyway. Researchers from Hadassah University in Jerusalem analyzed 7 accounts of such experiences obtained from in-depth interviews. And these were to devise a questionnaire which was sent out to 264 other people who gave their experiences. And they say the idea that life flashes in front of a person is featured in countless works of literature and film, but there has been limited research to explain what the phenomenon involves. But they say new study shines light on a most intriguing mental phenomenon that fascinated humans from time immemorial, which they coined life review experience, or the LRE. Those involved in the study said they lost all sense of time, with memories flying back at them from all periods of their life. One wrote, "There is not a linear progression. There is a lack of time limits. It was like being there for centuries. I was not in time or space, so this question also feels impossible to answer. A moment and 1,000 years, both and neither. It all happened at once, or some experiences within my near-death experience were going on at the same time as others, though my human mind separates them into different events." Another common feature were extremely emotional experiences, often from somebody else's point of view. One respondent said, "I could individually go into each person and I could feel the pain that they had in their life. I was allowed to see that part of them and feel for myself what they felt." Another said, "I was seeing, feeling things about him, my father in this case, they say, and he was sharing with me the things of his early childhood and how things were difficult for him." Every person in the study said they were left with a new perspective on life, life events, and on significant people in their lives. So that's a study they've done. Is there anything to it or not? I don't know. Maybe you have your own thought or your own experience on that. They call the phenomenon LRE. And that is sort of an interesting study, anyway, that they've looked at. And LRE stands for Life Review Experience. So there might be something to it. Maybe you have an experience like that, or you know somebody who has. So I don't know, again, if there is much to it, but certainly some interesting research that is out there. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining myself today, Dwight Falk. Make sure that you follow us online at KPCG-FM. Also, comments, you can send those comments at KPCG.FM. Have a great rest of your Monday. Talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.